not to support himself a little, so he made his money by doing microanalyses for people who couldn't do them themselves. In those days, we were supposed to do our own semi-microanalysis, right, of every new compound we made. And a few of us decided, oh goodness, that's chicken stuff. You have to learn to do microanalysis on 3 milligrams, 3 to 4 milligrams. Well, Turner was one of those who did, and Hans Simon was one who did. But any event, Turner was just about to leave. So I said, well, Dick, we've got a sample. Could you do this just, before you leave? Because it would make a big difference to Louis and me if you would run this analysis on trinitro. What was trinitro? I didn't tell him what it was. On the theory that you should never prejudice an analyst, right?
That's right.
This business of telling them in what rain you expect the carbon and the hydrogen for the birds. And all you're doing is destroying their objectivity. So Dick started to analyze it. Of course, you remember how that works? You weigh the thing into a little platen boat, shove it in this quartz tube, and then you've got this platinized or palladiumized asbestos down the tube, mm-hmm. and you follow it up with something other packing. So, but you gradually move the burner down, right, to vapor. And as soon as the flame got near this platinum boat, poof, his whole train was filled with carbon black. Well, that ended his analytical career. Maybe a day or two before it was going to end naturally. Oh, God, it was marvelous times. The Germans have a word to describe certain persons as tierisch ernst, which means having an animal-like seriousness about them. And I must say that there was very little of that in those days. I worked down, during my graduate work, worked in a room with four Fieser students. I was working with Lindstedt, right, in the room. Five of us down in the basement of Malincroft, which was far away, and so it was Dutch Siberia and so forth and so on. Louis would come in to talk to his people and would invariably throw his cigarettes still burning into the sink. And so the game was to try to guess when he was coming down and then pour ether in. Hopefully it would catch fire. Well, of course, a cigarette is something like, what's that lantern that they use in mines? It's just based on the principle that if you have a cold screen over the flame, that the explosion won't go past the screen. I forget the name of the lantern. Well, a cigarette works that way because the ash prevents it. But God, we were just so hoped this thing would blow up.
How long did you work with the explosives group?
I don't know, a few months. I mean, I made a fair amount of this trinitrobenzyl nitrate, but of course it was so sensitive that if you hit it with a hammer, it would detonate, so it wasn't really any good. Just overdid it. I went too far.
Did you get paid for that?
No, I can't remember.
You work with Lindstedt. You were really supporting yourself at that point.
Oh, yeah.
You still were supporting yourself. You didn't have a research fellowship or anything.
No. No, nothing. And then I got back to working with Lindstedt for a bit. and a fellow in the pharmacology department, Otto, his name escapes me, who was he wanted to isolate and separate the various minor components in the digitalis group of compounds. So I prepared samples of digoxin and gitoxin and things of that sort for them for a while, and then actually went through a traumatic time, and which Bob Woodward comes out as an absolute hero. Part of the Eggers family included the German Minister of Finance, who was ultimately in the Nuremberg trials. He was one of the two persons who were acquitted in the Nuremberg trials, but nevertheless he was not exactly the kind of person you wanted as a relative. But his mother was Danish, and so he and was a sister of my mother's mother, so that they were cousins. And so I always knew him as Uncle Hjalmar. His name was Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht. Can you believe it?
Incredible.
So there was quite during the war, quite a lot of anti-German feeling, as one can expect. There was clearly a very strong anti-Japanese feeling and so forth. These kind of things, these are natural. But it turned out that a very close friend of the family, Dr. Day, who had been the attending physician on Harvey's birth, and who had a son, Richard Day, who was in Shady Hill School with me, and in Belmont Hill School. He later became headmaster of Exeter Academy. He's now dead. But in any event, he went to Army Intelligence and said, you know, you've got to get rid of this Bill Dury, because there's too close a connection with the Nazis. And several of the persons in the chemistry department said, yeah, we've got to get rid of him. And it was Woodward and Lamb, but particularly Lamb, who said, no way. And as long as he is doing work, he mustn't work on secret work any longer. And so that took me off the mustard gas problem. And Bob then took advantage of it to get money out of Polaroid to work on the quinine synthesis. The importance to the war effort, of which could be justified sufficiently. Mm-hmm. But that was a bad time. I never told either of my parents about it. I just kept it totally quiet from them, because I knew my mother would be just desperately upset if she realized that that connection could really have seriously disrupted my career. I don't think I'm a total coward, but at the same time, I wasn't eager to get a gun on my shoulder and march off to war.
Who directed that mustard gas work?
Wasn't it Bald? What was Bald's? Eric Bald in the medical school was in charge of it, because it was a medical problem. The purpose of it was to find, well, a protective device against the toxic effects of mustard. Turned out to be a fascinating problem. Winstein was just at the beginning of the neighboring group concept, and mustard gas shows this funny property of solvolyzing, reacting with water, even in the presence of fairly strong bases by first order kinetics. That is, you can, it's not a second order displacement reaction, even though the chlorine is primary chloride, and an SN2 mechanism would have been a reasonable thing. But, and so that means that the destruction of it is very tricky. You can't accelerate the destruction of mustard gas by introducing strong nucleophiles. The only way really it's destroyed is by using alkali so concentrated that it changes the mechanism to an elimination reaction, so that you get ultimately divinyl sulfide. And so he had formulated this then, that the first step was the formation of a three-membered sulfonium intermediate, and that was later proved very nicely. And so what we were looking for were nucleophilic reagents so powerful that they would compete with the nucleophiles in the body for not scavenging mustard gas, but scavenging the intermediate before it could latch on to various critical points in the DNA and so on. Not that DNA was known at the time, but in retrospect. And that was really very, very interesting, because we developed all sorts of new nucleophiles, among them exceedingly powerful ones, di- and trithiophosphonic, phosphoric acid, various thiophosphonates, and so forth. And in the end, found a compound that was not toxic in any way, and you could sort of put 5% of it in a rabbit's blood and spray them with mustard gas, and nothing would happen. But isn't it amazing at those times? So I worked with, large quantities of mustard gas, and would just treat it and distill it and purify it and handle it in the hood. And I once splattered the tiniest drop into my eye, but it wasn't enough to make any difference. But for the rest, never had any trouble. And when you think back on it, that's what organic chemical techniques are all about. It's not that mustard gas isn't dangerous. Mustard gas is very dangerous. But as an organic chemist, what difference does it make? You know how to handle things without getting them all over you.
You said that Woodward had come to your defense along with Lamb. Was that your first interaction with Woodward, or had you been interacting with him earlier?
only in a very superficial way. And I think partly he was serving his own interest. That is, he certainly knew me well enough to know that I got around the laboratory pretty well. And by that time, he had already embarked on he already knew, certainly, that if you were going to become a synthetic organic chemist, targets that were not recognized widely would be just as difficult, might be just as difficult to synthesize as targets that were widely recognized. And so if you ask, how did he choose his problem? The synthetic targets. One of the a necessary condition for his target was that it should be a widely known natural product. Because only if the target was widely known would your reputation for having synthesized it be enhanced. And I don't think there's the slightest question about that. That is, that this is not cutting down anybody. I think that I knew Woodward well enough, and then the subsequent, if you go over the molecules which he did synthesize, they almost without exception fall into that category. Right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's all deliberate. Mm-hmm. Now, in the real defense for that, in my estimation, is this, that there's another way of synthesizing natural products. Suppose I discover a new reaction and I want it advertised. Then I should use it in the synthesis of a natural product. And so you see most synthetic organic chemists clearly go down huge lists of natural products until they find one, the synthesis of which will be appropriate to this new reaction. See a hell of a terpene synthesis of that sort, sesquiterpene and so forth and so on, where the natural product is chosen to fit the reaction, right? And the big synthetic chemists, the ones who distinguish, are in the Woodward class. That is, that the target is chosen, and now then, you didn't choose it because you know how to synthesize it, but you're going to devise a way of doing it. And so that the challenge is much better. And it falls into the same category, I mean, as the old saying, well, if you're going to marry for love, she might as well be rich. I mean, if you're going to choose a target, it might as well be an easily recognizable one. You're not choosing it because it'll be easy to synthesize. Well, so I don't think there's any incompatibility between Bob's behavior, which, between his practice of choosing well-known, well-recognized molecules, and certainly quinine during the war, malaria, and all that jazz. Can you imagine a better choice?
No, I want to get into some of the popular press descriptions in the New Yorker and Life, New York Times. Want to talk a little bit about that, but let's come back to the Woodward Polaroid connection. How did he and Land first join together?
He was a consultant for Polaroid, and I don't know what they were trying to do at that time, but I suspect that they were. You know, I think I'm right in saying that the first crystal to be used in making Polaroid film was quinine salt, that is hydro, it has no name anyway, the quinine salt of triiodide, I think that's right. And that this is the crystal that had birefringence, and also the physical property of crystallizing in flat, thin plates, such that when you put them into a polymeric support and stretched it, they would line up. And so Land was very much concerned about quinine not being available for that. I don't think he dreamt that synthetic quinine would have anything to do with it, but this was sentimentality. like quinon had put Polaroid into business, why not support its synthesis? And Bob's job when consulting with them was to find substitutes, which I think they did very quickly. I don't think it was much of a problem, but Bob was called in on that. Land was an extraordinary man. That is very, very intelligent, sharp, energetic, foresighted, really a remarkable person. I mean, I never knew him very well, but I certainly came to know him enough. And he recognized in Woodward, you know, a person who was just in a different category. So that he would have viewed Woodward by himself as a unique asset.
Mary Ellen has a letter which states that they would pay him $1,000. This was the start of June 1st of 1942. And the compensation was $1,000, but it's not clear if that, I guess that it says payable each month, so I assume that $1,000 was over a year's period, or would it have been?
I would have guessed, because Bob certainly wasn't floating in money and was really pressed.
He viewed the quinine synthesis as an intellectual exercise as much as any remote practical application.
Oh, sure. I mean, he wasn't in the least bit concerned about any application of it. And he had selected as a target for the reasons that at least I've implied. Mm-hmm. You couldn't have latched onto a natural product, the synthesis of which would have attracted more attention at that time.
Yes.
with the boys going off to the Asian jungles, the cinchona trees largely in the hands of the Japanese. They hadn't been transplanted to South America yet. If I remember correctly, those first plantations came during the war. Your story about your friend. And then it was also a challenge in the sense that long before that, the war, other persons had tried to synthesize it. Prelog was in the process of trying to synthesize it. And Raba had before him. And then it had been the goal of the younger Perkin, is that right, or the older Perkin, to synthesize it at a time when syntheses were developed by looking at the empirical formula, right, of quinine, breaking it down into two components, and I forget what the hell it was that he put together, but it might have been toluidin and, you know, some other thing, the result of which, and treated with sulfuric acid, it should have added up to quinine. And wasn't that the first synthesis of his dye?
Yes. Yes. It's the beginning.
It's very hazy.
It's the beginning of the whole synthetic dye industry.
Yeah. But what an intellectual story that is, isn't it?
Yes.
From putting empirical formulae together, sticking them in a lash, throwing in a reach. Dear God. So that not only was it wasn't a question of synthesizing a molecule that no one had tried to synthesize before, but there was a history of failure. So that from Bob's point of view, then this would let the chemical world know that they were dealing with someone quite special.
Where was Prelog in all of this synthesis?
Well, his story is that, you know, he read about it in the paper and just couldn't believe that two youngsters I put this together. And he still tells the story with great amusement. And
how long has his group been work trying?
And that I don't know, but it's in a matter of years. I mean, it was not
a long period of time.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But he had, this was what his, one of his major goals. So.
Well, what was Woodward's approach when he laid out the scheme? Did you participate in the...
In the construction of the scheme?
Yes.
Absolutely not. No. I mean, there is no intellectual input on my part in that original scheme. I mean, as the thing is going on and it runs into a little trouble here and there, I put in... Mm-hmm. A change of reaction here and a change of reaction there, but that's really minor stuff. I'm going to take a break and excuse myself.